You've landed inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
What's up, Launch Streeters? Tamara here, your host that clearly forgot her fancy headphones while traveling. Ugh, it's a little echoey in the intro and outro, but don't worry, it's just for those sections. The interview itself is amazing. It sounds good, and more importantly, it's got incredible insights. It's just on this little part while I'm talking, so we could probably get over it. And I'm in Kingston, Ontario, which is right on the water, and it's freezing cold, but gorgeous. So, you know, I guess there's that. Sorry about the headphones. All right, let's dig in. Have you ever felt frustrated or found yourself scratching your head because you're trying to balance being nimble and fast and, you know, adapt to change, and then yet making sure that you're even moving in the right direction, that you're even making the right decisions? Yeah, me too, which is why I had Jack Bergstrand pop by inside Launch Street with insights into exactly that. He wrote a fantastic book called The Velocity Advantage. And he was a senior exec at Coca-Cola before becoming president of Consequent, which helps companies, you guessed it, gain velocity. So here's the thing. Velocity is speed and direction. I think it's easy to go fast, but miss being strategic. And I think it's easy to have vision and direction, yet never go anywhere, get stuck in analysis paralysis. So I asked Jack to dig into how to do both, as well as how you know if you've got too much of one or the other. Interestingly, one of the biggest red flags that you don't have velocity, too many meetings. All right, let's do this. Jack, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Tamara.
So I have to know, what's your first memory of being innovative?
It's a hard one. You know, I was thinking, as you were saying that, thinking back to things in my childhood. And I guess one of the things that comes to mind is that, you know, a lot of people played house and things like that growing up. My friends and I, when we were around 7 or 8 years old, played City.
Oh.
And when I remember back to it, I think about some of the innovations. We had our own monetary system. We had our city in the attic of a friend's house, and they had all sorts of old stuff there. And we would buy and sell goods with the monetary system, and we really had fun. We would do it for an entire summer. So we would have division of labor, and people would have specific jobs. And so I guess that's my first memory, and probably one of the most fun things that we did as a neighborhood group of folks.
Now, was that something that your group of kids came up with? Did a parent suggest it? Because that takes like having a fort to a whole new level.
Yeah, we came up with it ourselves. I mean, we had these marathon Monopoly games that would also go on all summer. And so it was more an extension of these. And we had a bank, truly a bank that loaned out money and charged interest. And so that nobody had to go bankrupt. They just borrowed more money, but they would pay higher interest
rates.
More
credit card debt.
And that's right. So we were pioneers of the debt generation. But we had a lot of fun doing that. And I think playing City was just an extension of that for all practical purposes.
Yeah, I love the idea that you started almost like a trading post from the, you know, Wild Western days with your group. And to me, it kind of seems like a really good transition into business today. So let's dig into that. So based on your experience, which you've had quite a bit, I mean, first of all, you are a senior executive at Coca-Cola, as well as a founder of Brand Velocity, which you've worked with Fortune 500 and startups, kind of a broad range. You know, I know this is kind of an obvious question, but I'd love to dig in here. Why do you think innovation is so important?
Well, in a changing environment, it's critical because without it, you can't reconfigure yesterday's assets into tomorrow's competitive advantages. So it's very easy to get stuck. And when you look at any company's balance sheet, those are investments largely from the past. And they define a lot about the way companies operate, but also the way executives think within those companies. Peter Drucker, who's somebody that I had an affinity to, and I'm part of the Drucker Institute in Claremont, he wrote a book on innovation, and he wrote that the entrepreneur always searches for change, responds to it, and exploits it as an opportunity. And so I think when you look at companies, and even the largest companies in the world today, most of the innovation has grown on other people's trees. And so in most of the largest companies in the world have emerged from a founder in my lifetime. And that was not the case when I was a youngster.
I want to back up quickly and ask you about this phrase that you said. You said it and kind of passed over, but I think for us launch readers, it's really important. The reconfigure yesterday's assets to, I don't know if you said, create tomorrow's competitive advantages. And the reason I want to ask you about this, and maybe I'm jumping ahead, is because I think oftentimes we when we think about innovation, the myth out there anyway, at least how I see it, is that, you know, oh, well, it has to be totally different, totally new, totally disruptive, totally breakthrough. You've never done it before. But the challenge I find with that mentality is it leaves people, particularly inside larger organizations, really frustrated because they're dealing with kind of yesterday's stuff, right? They still have the realities. So how do you think about kind of bringing those two things together of yesterday's assets and tomorrow's advantages?
Well, it's a way to innovate and manage risk at the same time, because I do think people in large companies, some innovators, they are relatively ineffective because they might have great ideas, but there's not a natural way to get them implemented. And so when you look at implementing within companies, it's important, but it needs to be linked to some sort of execution and some way to reconnect it into the power structure of the existing organization. Now, on the other side of the equation, if you have a startup company and you have a new and innovative idea, that's a different kettle of fish, but it's something where 90% of startups fail. And so it may be very innovative, but an innovative idea that's part of a bankrupt company doesn't have that much impact either.
Right. Well, it doesn't actually get implemented. So what's right. The point? I know, kind of both sides are really tough. It seems to me that in today's age, and I 100% agree with you. I mean, I have a colleague who always says you can't get clean on yesterday's shower, which I think is genius because really you can't, success yesterday is not success today, definitely not tomorrow. But there's always this tension, at least that's what my clients tell me about, kind of what their reality is and what they have in front of them versus where they're trying to go.
Yeah. And I think the way to connect the dots is by connecting an innovative idea with a path to get it implemented. And I think it's very easy to get stuck in an established organization in sort of a purgatory of frustration and the over time, the inability to get something done, whether you believe it's great or not.
Yeah, so true. And I wonder if my next question kind of digs into the how, because I bet if I'm, like my other launch readers out there, I'm going, well, how do I do that then? So I want to dig into your book, The Velocity Advantage. And one of the things you talk about is it's not speed or direction, which I think we get stuck in those, I'm doing one or the other. You say it's about speed and direction, which is really the velocity advantage. What does that mean?
It's easy to be fast and it's easy to study things to death. But it's hard to be fast in a way that's sustainable, and it's easy to have a plan and be in a perpetual planning mode, particularly in a large organization or at least an established organization. And so you can focus a lot on planning and so direction, or you can say, let's just get her done and let's call that speed. But it's important to connect the dots on that, to have a direction that can be implemented in a relatively fast way. And so sometimes that feels, if you're a speed person, sometimes that feels slower by being clear on where it is you want to go and why before you start going forward.
Slow down, speed
up. Yeah, absolutely. And then there are planners who get into a comfort zone that there's always a better way. So as you put something on a whiteboard in terms of going forward, you could look at it every day for 5 years, and no doubt it would be better 5 years from now on the whiteboard than on the first year. But it would never be implemented. And so if it can't be implemented here too, innovation is sterile at best, but it's even worse than that because it absorbs resources that can't be deployed someplace else.
So I think we hear a lot about analysis paralysis, that kind of studying it to death, over planning. I want to talk a little bit about the other side, though. It's got me intrigued. What happens when all you have is speed? I mean, does that just lead to reckless implementation? Does that just lead to implementation that doesn't stick? I think especially with Agile, which is great, but some of those things kind of, what I hear people out there talk about is, I'm trying to move fast. I'm trying to move fast. But it sounds to me like there's a little bit of a balance here.
There used to be a silent motion picture called The Keystone Cops, and there's all these cops running around and not going in any particular direction. And that, particularly in an organizational context, is speed without direction. I remember we were brought in for a very large implementation of a software product across 200 countries. And the program had stalled. It was spending a lot of money. I was with the person who was overseeing it. He had an office pretty high up in Atlanta, and we were looking over a construction site, and I said, you know the difference between this particular project and that construction site? And he said, no, what? And I said, that construction site, they have a plan. And so not having a plan that's workable doesn't stop you from spending money. They were spending $500,000 a day on this project, and it was going nowhere because they were able to jump around from one new idea to another new idea, but they would get stuck. Other parts of the project were quite good at planning and had blueprinted this thing to many levels of detail, but in a way that organizationally was never going to get accepted. And so this whole notion of connecting the dots between a mindset of being fast, but also getting clear on where you intend to go and why, what you therefore need to do and when, how to best do those things, who's going to be responsible for what. As simple as that sounds, it does help you connect speed and direction, and that helps. That is a prerequisite, I believe, for actually implementing an innovation.
Can you, if you're a team leader, whatever that looks like, whether that's an internal, process team or a brand team with a, product in the marketplace, can you sit down and say, okay, we're going to get velocity, we're going to use speed and direction? Or does this have to be something that's already in motion?
I think it requires an intervention in most cases. We do collaborative strategy sessions and collaborative cross-functional project initiatives. The good thing is they don't take a lot of time. If you get the right people in the room and you determine, where you intend to go and why, what you therefore need to do and when, how to best do those things, who's responsible for what. Even for the most complex initiatives, it's pretty easy to get that done in a day. And that connects the dots between direction and speed in terms of the ability to implement it. And so it doesn't take a lot of time, but absent something that's relatively formal in terms of facilitating people through it, I think without, in very complex ones, I think the simpler they get, the easier it is to do without external help. But without that, then it's very easy to go in multiple directions. And in once you get far enough down the road where something has splintered, it's very hard to unboil that egg.
Can you walk us through a transformation about, you know, how that velocity turned things around, or kind of the start to finish of that case study?
Sure. I'll use the example that I used before on, you know, being in somebody's office and looking down at the construction site. The initiative had several hundred people working on it. It was global in nature. It was complex. And if you talk to them, we were brought in for to relook at it. If you ask 10 people what that project was supposed to achieve, you would hear 10 different answers. And you would hear it from and nobody who really needed to be involved was involved enough. Yet there were zillions of people who were involved who didn't need to be involved, and that just clogged the arteries even more. The governance structure was over 100 people. And the idea was that, well, you know, we've got 200 countries, we're paying $1 billion. We want to make sure this is done right. Let's get everybody involved.
Right. Everybody in the kitchen all together.
Yeah. And as you can imagine, pretty soon the people who were on the steering committee were sending their designates were sending their designates. As they started to smell blood, that this place was not going anywhere, people were jumping off internally and externally in terms of the external partners that were being used, because nobody wanted to be part of the failure. And so when it was reconstructed, the governance structure was three people. But they were the right three people. And you can imagine how much faster something can get done, even yeah. something that's very complex, when you've got the right people involved and they have the power to get done what they say needs to be done.
You know, it's just, I want to stop you on this for a second, because I think that we often confuse collaboration with consensus. And I mean, yeah. the reality is consensus is where both innovation and action go to die, really. Right. Nothing can happen. And I think real collaboration is actually the right people at the table at the right time talking about the right things. And when you have that, like you pointed out, where you go from 100 people, which is everybody, to three people, it's incredible how much you can get done. And not to say that other people's input doesn't count. It absolutely counts. But you got to get the right people around the table.
Yeah, because it has to be linked to power. I mean, consensus, I hate that term too. But I also hate the term alignment,
yeah,
because alignment is sort of like a head fake. It sounds like it's a good thing, but it means that people can keep going forward and never have to make a trade-off. So I prefer integration to alignment, because integration requires trade-off decisions to be made to get into a single way. And so parallel paths never have to meet. And so it does require the right people, but it also requires a common language and a common thought process to accelerate that. And that's really one of the core messages of the Velocity Advantage.
So you wrote an article that I read as part of the reason I think we reached out to you. And you talk about how knowledge is infinite, but temporary. Yet the knowledge is the key to today's changing world. So tell me a little bit about what you mean by temporary. And I got some other questions to follow, but we'll start there.
All right. Well, I mean, knowledge is a great thing, because unlike physical resources, you can use it and keep it at the same time. So it's infinitely scalable in that respect. But it does have, on the other side, a shelf life, because new ideas are emerging. And so when you think about knowledge, and the shelf life that it has, it's ultimately scalable on, you know, infinitely scalable on one hand, but it's not going to, those, that knowledge is not going to be relevant forever. And that time frame is getting smaller and smaller and smaller with, you know, every year. And so that's where the speed part of the equation comes in, because if you, you can have a great idea that you can execute in 3 years, or an idea that isn't nearly as good, but you can execute it right now and you can compete on iterations. The company that competes on iterations through taking advantage of speed is going to beat the company who had the better idea.
I want to go back to, I'm jumping around a little bit, but what you just said reminded me of this. I want to go back to this kind of the velocity thing, which I guess what you were saying really does link to, because it's the same thing with knowledge, right? If we're not continually adding to that knowledge and moving quickly to gain that, we become irrelevant in our own knowledge too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Here's my question. How do you know when you're going too fast or too slow, or how do you know if you're in the right direction or veering off? Because it's such a balancing act. I feel like it's, what is it, Goldilocks? Like, which porridge is just right? What are the, like, the real indicators of, hey, we're going too fast, we need to slow down, or, oh, we're going too slow, we need to pick it up? And same for direction.
Well, I think one of the indicators to both, in a way, because they're both part of a similar equation, are the number of meetings that people are having versus the number of outcomes that people are achieving. So sometimes meetings become both a way to avoid speed and also a way to never finalize a direction. And so the way that can be managed best is through, in my opinion, through collaborative sessions that get people to agree on and co-create. And this is not consensus, but it's getting everybody to understand the different perspectives and educate their way to convergence around, for a particular issue, where you intend to go and why, what you therefore need to do and when, how to best do those things, who's going to be responsible for what, so that you can walk away with a meeting with a plan, as opposed to a meeting that just results in continuous updates and never ever gets anywhere. And a lot of initiatives fall into that trap.
Well, it seems to me that, I mean, I can't tell you the number of those of us on Launch Street, and I've worked hard to get away from this, that are actually double booked all the time too for meetings. It blows my mind. Mm. I mean, I don't know how any of us get anything done when we're in meetings all day long.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a big problem. You know, I think automated calendars, which were supposed to help, I think made things much worse. But I think, you know, the meeting problem can be solved, I believe. You know, when I was the chief information officer at the Coca-Cola company, the calendar that I inherited had about 10 meetings per day. And it stretched out for roughly 3 or 4 months. And so anybody who wanted to see me, if they didn't bypass the system, literally would have to wait weeks, months. And so when you got a large initiative like the one I was mentioning before, where they're spending $500,000 a day, if it's taking you 2 weeks to get an answer, then that is costing you a fortune. By the time I left the Coca-Cola company, I was at most, I had 2 meetings per day, and the rest of the time I could think and I could anticipate things. And it's possible because so many of the meetings are scheduled by computer just to get a slot. And so there are, you know, lots of weekly meetings, biweekly meetings, monthly meetings. And most of those meetings, in my experience, only exist because they could get that meeting on your calendar and they didn't want to lose it. And so when I restructured things from a meeting perspective, I went one by one and I contacted these people. And a lot of the meetings were scheduled with like division heads and things like that. And I said, hey, you know, if you need something from me and I need something from you, let's try just reaching out to each other on a phone to see if that will work. And of course it did. And it was much more timely because something actually important needed to be made. And so it completely freed up the calendar. Now, having said that, I've seen that happen very, very few times where people actually are in control of their calendars. And the higher you go, the worse it gets.
Yeah. You know, someone told me once, and it was actually the most profound shift for me when I think about my calendar. They said the calendar is not a tool to give away your time. The calendar is a tool for you to schedule how to meet your aims, whatever those are. And the minute I realized that, I blocked out everything. I had like no meeting times for people to get. And but what turned out to kind of to your point, I know we're a little bit on a tangent about meetings, but I do think it speaks to culture and innovation. What ended up happening is people were incredibly succinct. They realized they could probably get what they needed from me by email or by stopping into my office or passing in the hallway. And the meetings that I did have were way more intentional and actionable because we knew that that was the only time we have for 2 days. But it was because I was blocking off most of my calendar anyway without them knowing.
Yeah. You know, I think that's really important stuff. I think with email, it's similarly important in that, you know, I used to get a lot of emails, like particularly at, you know, in a large corporation. And I basically disassembled that the same way that I did the meetings. And so one of the things that I watched that I think backfires on people is that they're getting so many emails that they don't answer them.
Yeah.
So, but what that does in effect, unless they manage it differently, is it will end up getting more emails and you'll get copied on more things. Mm-hmm. And because they haven't heard back, they just keep hounding you.
Yeah.
And so the easiest way that I've experienced in order to manage the email piece, kind of like with meetings, is to ensure that you're only getting the emails that you actually need. And sometimes that requires reaching out to somebody because usually it's 20% of the people who are generating 80% of them. So it's something that can be managed. And I can tell you it was not uncommon to have less than 5 emails in my inbox that were things that still needed to be worked on. But you look at companies and executives today, it is not uncommon for them to get hundreds of emails per day. It is completely unmanageable, but it can be managed.
Yeah, you know, and I think for those of us on Launch Street, I think this is actually important. While it may seem like a very tactical tangent, is because that, I think, really hinders your ability to go fast and to have direction because you're really bogged down in stuff that's sucking your mind time that you don't need to be and your actual physical time. And I think getting away to kind of, Jack, what you're saying, kind of really owning your calendar and your email, your communication, how you work, really helps us become better innovators.
Yeah, I think there's no doubt about it. And the truth is that there are, so out of 100 emails, there are a few of them that really are critically important, and particularly in large companies, big decisions are resting on them. And if they can't get your input when they need it, then tremendous number of dysfunctions occur, and a lot of resources get wasted while people are waiting for these decisions to get made.
Yeah, and that slows everybody and everything down. And, you know, since we're talking about workplace, what do you think are some of the biggest opportunities business leaders should keep in mind when considering innovation within their workplace?
I think in general, there are a couple of things. I think there's a lot of value to a common language to think about innovation. And in the Velocity Advantage, we use Envision, Design, Build, Activate. It doesn't have to be that language, but some common way to get past all of the different functional
to talk about
acronyms
innovation.
And yes, and getting and having a way to make sure that the right things are being done in the right order. You know, that a common process, you know, as part of that is important. I think small teams, you know, and cross-functional integration are important. And also not forgetting the linkage between innovation and execution, because a great idea not implemented is no better than not having a great idea.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I do a lot of keynote speaking, and the part that I'd say that really resonates with people, and, you know, the ones that kind of come up to me after and say, oh my God, that was great, thank you, isn't necessarily the part about how to be more innovative, although that's important and relevant, but it's also the part about how do you communicate ideas so you can actually get some action. It's that second half of the marathon that I think often gets left behind or not talked about because we're so busy. How do you create the ideas? Extremely important. But we don't often talk about the execution or the buy-in or the momentum that has to happen.
Yeah, it's critical. You know, a lot of the on the velocity advantage, a big part of that, using different terminology, but is to connect the dots between design thinking and design doing.
Yeah.
Because it's as great as design thinking is, it usually stops short of that implementation piece. And so connecting the dots between innovation and execution, and part of, you know, the velocity advantage is dedicated to that for the most part, is critical, because until you start implementing, you really don't know what you've been thinking. And so once you take an idea and begin to implement it, that's where all the learning begins to occur. And the things that you didn't think about start to pop up. And that creates even more opportunities for innovation as you begin to apply.
Yeah, I think if we look at the winning cultures out there, they have a culture of experimentation, not one of presentation. And to your point, it's very thoughtful. It's not, you know, let's throw it all to the wall and see what sticks, which I think is a big differentiator between those that kind of are doing well in this changing marketplace and those that are struggling a little more. I want to bring it back to you for a minute. How do you innovate? What do you think your kind of personal approach to it is?
Well, usually some of it, you know, I don't know that there's a formula. There are aspects of ideas, I think, come to us. And who knows where these ideas come from sometimes. But where I get ideas, I get ideas usually when I'm observing others. And so if I'm sitting in a meeting or a cross-functional session or hearing different people with different points of view on an issue, that for me personally will generally lead to an idea. But for me personally, then the true innovation comes when I try to fine-tune it through application and cross-functional input, ongoing simplification, because I think there are sort of altitudes within an idea. Ongoing simplification, applying it in a particular environment, all of that is important, whether you're in a small company starting in something that's new or you're in a large company that's trying to add on to a current product or replace a current product or do anything from supply chain to organizational turnarounds or whatever it happens to be.
In your work, what do you think stops individuals from innovating? What have you seen?
Well, kind of like we talked about before a little bit, and as far as mistaking meetings for work, I think that's a big one. I think we have probably three generations of managers at this point who think one who mistake one for the other. I'm sure at some point that wasn't a problem, but meetings are really what's a big thing, and the wrong kinds of meetings, a big thing that stops people. I think giving up is another. It's so easy to come up with an idea, and because it doesn't take off immediately, that people give up and pushing it and not selling that idea to the power structure. I think not embracing a spirit of action, imperfection, forgiveness, continuous improvement, and not connecting the dots between innovation and execution. All of those things, I think, stop people from achieving all that they could achieve.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned the kind of the first brick wall or the first roadblock that people hit. And I'm just having a conversation with another, you know, leads a fairly large team in the construction world, actually. And he was saying that his big frustration with his team is he feels like the minute they hit that first brick wall, they stop.
Right. You do need to stick with it. I mean, it's just like a startup company, really. You know, it is, you know, it's hard slugging there, and you need to prove your idea, and you'll encounter many different barriers that you also need to innovate around. But you eventually go from something that's an idea to something that's implemented. But it does take courage and it takes persistence.
Yeah, that is so true. So before I ask you the last question, where can people go to learn more and connect with you?
My email address is jbergstrand, so J-B-E-R-G-S-T-R-A-N-D, at consequentwithoutvowels.com, so C-N-S-Q-N-T.com.
Got it. And is there a website or a blog, or where else can we send them?
The website, www.cnsqnt.com. There's plenty of information and plenty of ways to get in touch with me.
Awesome. We'll put those links in the show notes. For the last question, what is the first step us LaunchStreeters can take to pick up our velocity?
I think the best thing to do is to keep in mind that the dots need to get connected between where you intend to go and why in a given time frame. We call that envision. Mm-hmm. And then based on that, what needs to happen when, which we call design. Then based on that, how to best do those things, which we call build. And then who should be responsible for what, which we call activate. And I think getting the right things done in the right order is the easiest way to start to connect the dots between innovation and execution.
So I know I said last question, but I have one more now that you said something you said sparked this. And it goes back to your case study about, you know, going from 100 decision makers to 3. What do you, I have to imagine, and tell me if I'm wrong, that when you decide to pick up velocity and really speed and direction and the implications of that, fewer meetings, fewer emails, fewer decision makers, a lot of experimentation, kind of the things that we've talked about through the podcast, I have to imagine that there's some resistance and people who aren't on board, who really kind of fight it because it probably means some change for them. If you're the leader in that scenario, what do you do in that situation? Are those people, frankly, just not the right people? I'm okay with that, but, or is there a way to get them on board with what you're trying to do? Hopefully that made sense. I went in circles there.
Part of the short answer is not everybody needs to be involved in everything. And just as often as you might run into somebody who feels like they've been left out, there are situations, and probably even more so, where people are relieved that they can go back to their day jobs, that they don't have to be going to all these meetings.
There's more relief than stress.
I think so. And I think when you get the right people in the same room at the same time with the right power to get things done, then it helps the huge majority. So if you go from 120 people to 3, there are 117 people that are generally relieved.
That's an interesting way to look at it. I was kind of going the flip side of the people who are maybe not okay with the speed and direction, but I hear what you're saying. I think if I talked to some of my clients and said, what would you do if I told you I could eliminate your meetings by 70%, they would probably cry because it is such a frustration for them.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the key to that is it needs to be done from the top. If you try to do it from the middle, there's no chance. But if they know that their bosses believe that they've got this, and when they need their help, they'll reach out, then it will help you get to speed and direction, because you'll have the right people who are leading it. And part of the reason why so many large initiatives struggle is because there is no one who's directly leading it. You've got dozens of people leading different parts of it, and there's no way to bring it together and to make trade-offs and move it forward.
Jack, this has been so insightful. Thank you so much for coming by Launch Street.
Thank you, Tamara. It was an absolute pleasure, and I really appreciate the opportunity.
Okay, fellow Launch Streeters, time to figure out if you've got velocity, analysis paralysis, or a road rash from moving too quickly. And you know better than anyone that it's one thing to start with velocity and another to keep it. So if you want to ensure you maintain that positive forward momentum, I suggest going to our website and checking out our IQE Pro Toolkit. We've got an individual and a team version. It's the top innovation tools delivered directly to your inbox so that you can go further down the right path faster. The link is in the show notes. Tamara, out.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, launchstreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.